Support comes from San Diego Zoo Global, presenting Africa Rocks this summer at the San Diego Zoo, with 6 different African habitats, including an aquatic display featuring African penguins. The fun starts rolling out all summer long. Learn more at sandiegozoo.org.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We moved production offices 3 times. We took everything that we were doing offline, and we're doing all of our editing between hard drives. And I began to understand more and more how serious this was and essentially where it went to, that there wasn't much separation between Gregory and Putin.
Brian Fogel's plan was to make a documentary about pervasive doping and cycling by becoming a human guinea pig to see whether he could dope and evade detection. He recruited chemist Gregory Rodchenkov in Moscow to guide him, and then the plot thickened. Rodchenkov was revealed as the architect of Russia's massive state-run doping program, and he was ready to blow the whistle. With that, Rodchenkov feared he was no longer safe from Russian authorities, and apparently with good reason. Fogel helped him flee, and then things got really scary. Fogel tells us about taking extreme precautions while working on his movie Icarus, and explains why all the unanticipated twists of the story meant that a $5 million sale at Sundance didn't come close to covering the cost of making the film. But first on the News Banter, independent film is riskier business than ever. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my comrade in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So this past week, we've had a kind of vivid illustration of the vagaries of the movie business. Open Road, the company that just a couple of years ago was celebrating a Best Picture win for Spotlight, has basically had to sell itself at the brink of destruction because this business of making and distributing movies, it's just incredibly risky.
It's extremely risky, and it's getting riskier because you're seeing pressure put on both sides of the distribution business. On the upper side, let's call it, you have the tentpolization of movies, where the big studios are really only interested in producing franchise tentpole films, and you're seeing the film weekend calendar just get clogged and clogged and clogged with franchise and superheroes and sequels and prequels and everything else that we know about the modern movie business. Then on the other side, you're having the bottom fallout because the independent world is being consumed by Netflix and by Amazon and by these streaming companies that are going to film festivals and going to filmmakers and lavishing huge amounts of money on these smaller films in order to stock their own pipeline for their streaming services. So where does that leave these independent movie distributors that are counting on screens in the theater to make their money? It doesn't leave them in a great place.
Yeah, another company, Broad Green, is laying off its production staff and going into distribution only, which will not necessarily be much easier. And then I wrote a story this past week about Megan Ellison, who is the daughter of Larry Ellison. Now, he is one of the richest guys in the world. He supposedly gave her $2 billion. She's been investing in movies, and she definitely likes quality films. Things like Zero Dark Thirty, The Master, Her. You know, she did do Sausage Party, so that was a bit of an outlier. But mostly, it's been this kind of Academy bait movie. And, you know, that's worked out really in a kind of mixed way for her, because Her or Foxcatcher, these are movies where she did not make money. She was investing in David O. Russell's Joy, definitely lost money. And now she's nonetheless become even more ambitious, and she has decided to build her company, Annapurna, into a company that does everything, including television, including online games, also including making and distributing movies. And I think a lot of people are rooting for her because of the kind of movie that she invests in, but everybody really knows how much the deck is stacked against this kind of effort.
Yeah, a figure like Megan Ellison is great in Hollywood because she has amazing taste. She was the first woman to get 2 Best Picture nominations as a producer a few years ago.
In 1 year, that is.
In 1 year.
Yes, Her and American Hustle.
But she has now ballooned her company up to about 120 employees. She's trying to be a distributor. And the perfect test case is the first movie out of the block for her, which is Detroit, the Catherine Bigelow movie about the Detroit riots. This is a movie that is extremely difficult to sell to a mass audience. It costs between $40 and $50 million, which is very high for this kind of movie. And it's being released in the summer, not during the awards corridor, for reasons I'm not quite sure, but it basically needs to gross double that to make its money back. And I'm not sure it's going to.
Yeah, there are a couple of reasons why. One is that it's the 50th anniversary of the events in question. And the other is that other movies with African-American leads have done well in that period. But those movies are The Help, Straight Outta Compton, Lee Daniels' The Butler. Anybody who's seen a Kathryn Bigelow movie knows that her movies are much more somber. This movie is much more dark than those other movies. Some, they deal with serious subject matter, but they have a much lighter sort of feel about them.
The thing here to think about is that Megan Ellison has a lot of money. She could float this company for 10, 20 years if she wants to. The question is the prestige filmmaker-oriented production distribution company a real potentially profitable business? And given the landscape right now, I don't know if starting a studio from the ground up like this is a viable business.
It has proved pretty much impossible for a lot of other people who have had these dreams. And so we will watch, and a lot of people will be hoping for the best, but who knows? So let me pivot to HBO. HBO has been the target of a very vicious cyber attack. This is 7 times the amount of data that was taken from Sony. We have not seen emails come out at this point, and it is unclear whether that will happen. But I will note that, you know, HBO, maybe for having learned from Sony, has been really proactive about addressing this in the public manner and trying to figure out how to get their arms around this thing.
Yeah, and from the people that I speak to at HBO, their priority is the employees and the internal information. It would be awful if episodes of Game of Thrones or other shows leaked online, but Game of Thrones is already the most pirated show on television, and that's not going to really damage the company. The internal emails or passwords or personal information of employees, that's really where the damage can be done. And, you know, HBO is already offering assistance to people who may fear that their identities will be stolen or credit card information compromised. But when you speak to them, the corporate culture of HBO is very strong, and it starts with the CEO, Richard Plepler, who has been very proactive about addressing this. They're worried about their employees, and that's the priority.
I will just note that this comes as AT&T's acquisition of HBO's parent company, Time Warner, seems to be very close to closing. And, you know, this has been analogized by one expert to the Yahoo hack. Yahoo is acquired by Verizon. Their customer accounts were compromised, at least 500 million of them. And that meant a $350 million discount in its purchase of Yahoo, in the Verizon purchase of Yahoo. Now, I haven't heard anything about whether AT&T is going to react in that manner. It's probably much too soon to say. But my point is, this kind of thing can have a real impact on the value of an asset.
Yeah, this is a somewhat different situation in that HBO doesn't have the kind of customer profile information that Yahoo had, and that made it so damaging when it was leaked. But the timing issue is what the person was comparing it. And the timing of this is definitely not good, because AT&T, they are now getting the message. This is what they're buying. They are buying the company behind the biggest show on television, Game of Thrones. And this hack seems to be somewhat related to the fact that Game of Thrones is on HBO. And I don't know, you know, you look at this when you're AT&T and you're like, this is not good.
Nevertheless, they will persist. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. As the new documentary Icarus begins, it looks like director Brian Fogel will also be its subject. Fogel is an amateur cyclist who decided to undergo a doping regimen to see if he could improve his performance in races, all while avoiding detection. For help in this quest, he found a willing accomplice in Dr. Grigory Rodchenkov, a chemist who ran the largest anti-doping laboratory in Russia. The two connected over Skype.
But what is your ultimate purpose? You would like to beat doping test? You would like to start your hormonal program?
Yes.
Then give sample and prove negative?
Yes.
Ha ha ha.
Things soon became much more serious than either Fogel or Rodchenkov anticipated. After Fogel's experiment was well underway, it was revealed in the media that Rodchenkov was the architect of Russia's massive Olympic doping program. Once exposed, Rodchenkov felt he was in great danger from Russian authorities. It fell to Fogel to help him flee the country, almost certainly saving his life. Throughout all of this, the camera kept rolling, as it did when Fogel interrogated Rodchenkov once they were face to face.
Does Russia have a systematic statewide doping system in place to cheat the Olympics?
Yes.
Were you the mastermind of a statewide system that cheated the Olympics?
Of course. Yes.
Was Putin aware of the existence of a Russian doping system?
Yes, aware of my name.
With the subject of his film transformed, it seemed that Fogel could also be in the crosshairs. All of this was nothing that Fogel could ever have anticipated years earlier when he was, believe it or not, attempting to become a comedian and was consumed with a project called Jewtopia.
It started in 2003, and long story short, me and a great friend of mine, Sam Wolfson, decide that we're going to write a play. And this play strikes a chord. It's this, you know, just kind of over-the-top comedy. I'm starring in it with Sam. We've produced it. We've basically done everything to put this show together. We've racked our credit cards. And the show turns into this unbelievable hit and ran for 1,300 performances off-Broadway. And then adapted the play very, very loosely into a film. And I was very set to direct. I wanted to be a filmmaker. And it came out in 2013. It was a fun movie, but it wasn't really released in theaters. And to me, it was a disappointment. And there were so many things that I learned as a filmmaker that I said to myself, if I'm given the chance, I'll do better next time. And I didn't know when that next time was going to be. And I spent about a year and a half kind of in a really depression, trying to figure out what my next project was going to be.
It did not get love.
No. And it didn't help my career to the next level. I was hoping that this film would open doors for me to continue to direct. And it didn't do that. And so I found myself starting over again. And in starting over, I went back to cycling because riding my bike was something that I had done my whole life. I started racing bikes when I was 13 years old, and it had been my therapy throughout my life. And it was around the same time that all the Lance Armstrong allegations were getting really, really heated. And in January 2013, he comes out on Oprah and he confesses that he had been doping his whole career. But underneath that Armstrong story, to me, was a bigger story. And that bigger story was, even though he had confessed, this guy to this day had still passed 500 anti-doping controls clean. He has never been caught.
They turned people, and that's the way they got it, right?
Exactly. It was like catching Al Capone
on tax
evasion.
Your blood was not good. It was like somebody told us what you did.
You got it. And I'm going, wait. This appears to be a fraud. If the most tested athlete on planet Earth, forget about cycling, have been able to evade positive detection for 13, 14 years, what did this mean for all of sport?
Well, so let me ask you, so you then decide you're going to explore this world. Are you more interested in what the physical effect of doping will be on you as a cyclist, or are you more interested in figuring out if you can beat the test, or is it just both?
It was really both. And I think that probably anyone who has been a competitive athlete and didn't turn professional, I think there's always been that curiosity in the back of your mind when you're reading all this stuff of, what do these drugs do?
If
what
I had
does
the
doping
good juice,
do?
Maybe I would be winning this thing.
Exactly. Like, if I had taken this stuff, could have I been a professional athlete? But then aside from personal curiosity, I was really, really interested to see if what Lance had done could still be done, but also what this meant for all of sport and investigating this system behind professional sports.
And then when you say investigating the system, you're talking like with a small eye, not the giant investigating the system that was to ensue. But let's not get ahead. I'm curious, when you set out to do this, how is that put together? Who finances that?
I came up with a pitch, and the plan was essentially this 2-year plan. I was going to go do this race in Europe clean, And then I was going to go back the next year, dope. And then I was going to try to evade detection. And along that route, I was going to be advised by scientists, which in my initial treatment, you know, the guys who I thought were going to help me ended up changing. And that I was going to show whether or not the anti-doping system was working, whether or not I was caught. And then behind that, I was also going to be interviewing athletes and journalists on the anti-doping system in sports. So based on that, this kind of supersize me journey into doping in sports, I was able to raise a first chunk of money, this first basically $350,000.
From
a guy who had been a friend and a businessman and wanted to help me. And he essentially invested for me to get started on this. And at the end of this first year, I put together what is like this 25-minute short film. Because I didn't have any more money to continue. I'd basically spent that money in shooting the entire first year and traveling and doing this race. Gregory was in it, but you know,
you had already found Gregory.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there were other scientists in it. There were other interviews in it.
So let me just try to get the timeline in my head a little, because the spotlight really starts to turn to Gregory, if I've got it right, with this German article.
Right.
Where does that in relation to your connection with Gregory? I mean, were you in, had you started talking with him already?
Yes.
So you've done your first race and you were getting ready to start doing those shots. And you know that the spotlight is turning towards Gregory or has turned.
Well, it was actually a slow process. You know, in December 2014, after I'd already been filming basically since the prior April, I had met Gregory, we had spoke. This German documentary breaks alleging that there's a state-sponsored program in Russia. It's alleging that Gregory is essentially overseeing this program. And at the same time, I'm beginning to dope. And Gregory is working with me. And I make this decision that I had one of two choices at that point. Choice one is I turn into investigative journalist and I lose Gregory. Choice two was I had this friendship. He was helping me already on what I thought was going to be a very interesting film. And he's this incredible personality and he's willing to help me do this. And so I said, hey, I don't have control of where this investigation is going to go, but what I do have control over is my journey and the film that I'm making. So I decided that I would just continue with that plan. And so the entire year that Gregory is under investigation and they're investigating the lab, he's also advising me how to dope. He comes to Los Angeles and helps me smuggle my urine back to Moscow.
And he's doing all of this on camera.
Which is, it's unbelievable.
I mean, did you
absolutely
sort of, you didn't just find somebody, it's you sort of indicate in the film, it's not like there are scientists growing on trees who are just dying to help you A, dope, and B, dope on camera.
And C, that are running a WADA lab, a World Anti-Doping Agency lab.
Did you have any idea going into it that Gregory could be literally in the crosshairs? I mean, did that ever occur to you at the beginning or no?
The whole thing was so surreal. It was surreal that this guy was helping me and he shouldn't have been helping me. But this is the guy running the third largest anti-doping lab who's overseeing all the testing for Sochi. And he's also in my kitchen at my dining room table coding my urine samples to smuggle back to Moscow. I mean, all of this was so illogical in a, you know, this shouldn't be happening point of view. But I could have never imagined, I mean, in a million years, that essentially he was and is Snowden of Russia. And he not only was deeply involved in this program for, you know, the last 12 years of it, was the mastermind of this program, was truly the center, the epicenter of this program. And not only that, he had the evidence. He had been keeping the evidence.
Well, it made me wonder whether he's obviously brilliant, whether he knew when you reached out at that moment, like the sands are running through the hourglass, and if maybe this gets me out of here somehow.
You know what? I've asked Gregory that. I haven't been able to speak to him for over a year now since he's been in protective custody. But during the making of this and everything, I'd constantly ask him that. And he would say to me, he's like, look, first of all, I just thought what you were doing was interesting and sounded fun to me. Second of all, we really developed a trust. And I said to him at the time, and I meant it, and I said, look, anything that we do, whatever we film, at the end of a day, I'm going to show you this movie. And if it jeopardizes you or your career, then you and I will figure this out. And I'm not going to put out anything to harm you. And so he then proceeded to operate in unimaginable good faith and allowed me to capture on camera a million things that I really shouldn't have captured. And in return, when the going got rough for him and he was in jeopardy of his life, I felt that at that point it was about a friendship, and I felt this incredible moral and ethical obligation to help him as a friend because he had helped me, and that was what I did.
Okay, so you had your 25-minute thing back, as you said, to seek more funding to keep this alive, and I don't know if that worked.
It did. A company called Impact Partners, Dan Kogan, who's an exceptional documentary producer, it made its way to him. And Dan called me a few days later and he said, look, I love what you're doing. What do you need? What do you need to finish this film? And at the time, the amount of money that I needed to finish the film actually would turn out to be a small fraction of the money that I would ultimately need to finish the film. But Dan Kogan and his group of investors came on board the project. And then when the film took a turn, and we were suddenly playing with life and death and these incredible high stakes, these people didn't run away. They basically backed up the truck, and these guys kept the ball rolling.
Coming up after a short break, director Brian Fogel tells us about fearing for his own safety while making Icarus and why he chose Netflix to distribute his film. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Support for this program comes from Soothe. If you're feeling tired from a long commute, stressed from a busy work week, or your body aches from a tough workout, Soothe can help. Soothe's vetted and certified therapists have helped over 100,000 people feel better with spa-quality massages at your home or office in as little as 1 hour. De-stress and let the relaxation come to you when you want, where you want. Book an appointment now at Soothe.com and use code KCRW for $20 off your first massage.
Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to director Brian Fogel. His new documentary, Icarus, is now available on Netflix. What started as a kind of Super Size Me for sports, in which Fogel, an amateur cyclist, planned to test out doping strategies on himself, morphed into a real-life thriller. In the midst of Fogel's experiment, it was revealed in the media that the advisor guiding Fogel's doping program, a Russian chemist named Grigory Rodchenkov, was deeply involved in running Russia's massive doping program. After Rodchenkov was named in a November 2015 report from the World Anti-Doping Agency, he began to fear that with the truth coming out, he was no longer safe from Russian authorities. And it seemed he had good reason. In February 2016, after Rodchenkov had fled Russia with Fogel's help, one of his colleagues in the doping effort died suddenly of a heart attack at age 52. In Icarus, we see Fogel and Rodchenkov as they learn of the death.
Nikita Kamayev's death comes just 2 months after he resigned his post, which is obviously following the doping scandal that has rocked Russia and the rest of the world in athletics.
He's my friend since school time, and he never complained about his heart or any health problem. And
we had to figure this out because
Brian, we are playing the most dangerous game in the history of sport.
Did you think you were in danger?
Yes. We moved production offices 3 times. We took everything that we were doing offline, and we're doing all of our editing between hard drives. And as I began to understand more and more how serious this was and essentially where it went to, that there wasn't much separation between Grigory and Putin. And so once we saw this and understood this, it was very, very tense. While we were continuing to film, we were in a daily crisis management situation. And it was so many sleepless nights and so many phone calls with Dan. of how do we protect Gregory? How do we protect the film? How do we protect this evidence? How do we bring this story forward? What do we do? What do we do? And that was very, very, very stressful. And I was looking over my back the whole time. And so we had a decision, and the decision was, okay, one, do we want all the athletes of the world who are going to the Rio Olympic Games to have this information? Do we want the world to have this information? And do we want to uphold Gregory because he had risked his life, he had left his family, he was never going back to Russia ever again, and he was here in America to tell his story? And what were we going to do with that? And the decision at that point was incredibly clear, which was we had to go to the New York Times.
I mean, I appreciate all of your reasons, and I think they're very well-founded for going to the Times. I wondered if you had some inner journalist saying, but this is my scoop.
Oh, I did. I mean, I really did. And we had this idea that we were going to break this in the film. But ultimately, I realized that that was not what I was there to do.
And that sounds almost spiritual.
Yeah, because it was more important that this story come forward. And had we tried to release this in a film, it would be attacked. Russia and everybody else would go, oh, this is bull. This is one man's story. How are you going to prove it? How are you going to prove it? And the only way that it could be proved was through another investigation, which we didn't have the power to do, so that New York Times piece set off, then the next investigation. And ultimately, everything that Gregory had brought forward was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So yes, you can still have denials, but there's all sorts of deniers in this world. It doesn't make it true.
So when you take the film to Sundance, it was $5 million sale. So I don't know if that helps to defray or covers or, but.
You know, I think on the outside, everybody's going, oh my God, you just got rich. And I'm going, oh my God, you have no idea how much money this movie cost to make, because there were spectacular expenses that really had nothing to do with a regular making of a film. But the decision to go with Netflix, outside of my own needs as a filmmaker to always want your film in a cinema, but on a social level, I couldn't think of no better company than Netflix, and that's why we made that decision.
And then Sundance gets hacked. What are the odds?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there were a lot of suspicion that it was because of Icarus. I don't know.
The film is about to drop, and you're just waiting to see what will happen?
Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen. I think if you were to ask most people on the planet right now, are you aware of the Russian doping scandal? They'd say, yeah, I heard something about it. But I think that the power of cinema is when you see something, like when you see a film like Blackfish and all of a sudden understands how SeaWorld was treating their animals. And so when this film comes out, I think the cinematic journey, and here is the undeniable truth and evidence, no matter what you want to say, no matter what Russia wants to say, I think we haven't, and I haven't seen the ramifications of that, the fallout of that, or what this actually means yet. Because I think there are going to have to be things that are going to change, and hopefully they change as a result of this film.
Brian Fogel is the director of the documentary Icarus, now available on Netflix. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here, and I hope a lot of people will see the film. And also in light of current events, if there's any question as to whether or not our election was hacked or the reach of what a global superpower can do to assert itself, I think that this film answers a lot of those questions.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.